early universe or more recent times, and then they're going to inject energy into the intergalactic medium through the Hawking radiation. The other is if they're larger and they're too big to evaporate by the present day, then they might be accreting baryons, and then you'd get X-ray radiation from the accretion disk. So I'm going to talk mostly about the first case, the evaporation, and then I'll also mention the accretion, which is what my recent work on the archive is about. So for the accretion, I forgot to write down the archive number, but you can find it. So basically, you have if you have black holes that are massive enough at early times, they'll accrete baryons and create X-rays, and those can increase the tau, the optical depth to electron scattering to the CMB, and you can see that in principle with CMB polarization. And the point of the paper is that the polarization signal you'd get from this kind of energy injection is distinct from what you'd get from just changing the redshift of reionization if you think that's more or less instantaneous. So it might lead you to misestimate the parameters. So here's a plot from that paper. The dots crosses are the WMAP if you set the reionization redshift at, I think it's redshift of 11, and the solid line is if you have primordial black holes accreting, and these are both for the same value of the of tau, the optical depth. So you can see the signal is quite different, and if you get tau wrong, since tau is related to other parameters and their degeneracies, you might have you might estimate the other parameters incorrectly as well. And then, so the point is just that taking into account the primordial black holes for this kind of measurement can be important. And specifically, some of the things that taking this into account can do is that if you have sort of an ordinary reionization scenario, but then you also have primordial black holes injecting energy and raising the ionization fraction a little bit earlier on, it might allow for a higher value of sigma 8, the amplitude of fluctuations, which might bring the CMB and large scale structure probes into slightly better agreement. So that's kind of the point of that paper. I wasn't as key involved in that paper, so I'm not going to talk about it as much. I'm going to talk more about the more recent work on evaporating primordial black holes. So the idea here is just that you have little primordial black holes that are evaporating in the early universe or in the dark ages, and they can ionize and heat up the IGM. And the thing that can make these potentially quite interesting is that if they're at the moment they're evaporating, the energy injection goes up quite a lot, so you can have quite a strong signal at that time if they're all produced at the same mass, and I'll talk a little bit about that later. And currently, the best constraints on these are from the gamma ray background at around 10 to 15 grams, and you get constraints that say that the density parameter of primordial black holes is less than 10 to the minus 10, and we can do a little bit better than that in some regimes with what I'm going to talk about today. So the overall gist of this talk, so you know before I go into it, you might have primordial black holes in the early universe. If they're injecting energy into the IGM, this will affect the ionization and temperature, and specifically the 21 centimeter line of neutral hydrogen is a very good probe of this kind of physics, and I'm going to talk about that primarily. It can do a little bit better than the CMB for reasons I'll explain. So just a overview of reionization. Probably most of you know about this, but the basic idea is that you have CMB and then recombination, and for a while just nothing at all is happening. You have gravitational collapse, nothing is lit up yet. You have no stars or galaxies. And when those start to form, they're going to ionize the gas around them. At some point, the universe will become transparent. And that's reionization right here. And in between the CMB and reionization are the dark ages, so-called because there's no light being produced, and it's opaque to most of the light we're trying to look at things with, so we just don't know anything about what's going on there.
It's because the neutral hydrogen is absorbing the light very well.
Or is it on?
Yeah. So the CMB passes right through because that's very low energy, but visible light gets absorbed. So right now the best kind of handle we have on wind reionization curve aside from the CMB is looking at
quasar absorption spectra, and this is some composite spectra from quasars at low Z and low redshift and high redshift, and the difference here is just that at low redshift the light blueward of Lyman alpha comes right through, and at high redshift it gets completely absorbed in the neutral IGM. And this is a sort of schematic of what we hope to be able to do with 21 centimeter, which is to see the universe becoming ionized over time, and I'll explain how that comes to be. But the idea is that it's a signal that's not just one picture or one data point or an integrated signal. You might actually get slight time slices. So the 21 centimeter signal, it's the hyperfine splitting of neutral hydrogen, just the spin flip between the nuclear and electron spin. And I mentioned that in the dark ages, UV and visible light are absorbed. So the reason that this line is particularly good, one reason is that it's radio, so it doesn't absorb very well. It also requires very little energy to excite it because it's very small transition in energy. So you don't have to have a whole lot going on to get this signal. And so the ultimate goal of these kinds of studies is to get something like the CMB at several different time slices. So it's tomography, like doing a CAT scan of the universe. And this is just a sort of picture of what you might look like, what you might get. This is from simulations at different redshifts. And the red here is the 21 centimeter signal from neutral hydrogen, in the black is where the hydrogen has been ionized, and so you lose that signal. And you can kind of see the neutral hydrogen going away. And there are a lot of different proposals right now for ways to observe this. I don't know if anybody can recognize these by sight. This one's labeled, this is LOFAR, which is being built in the Netherlands right now, and they're doing a large array of telescope of antenna that look like this. In fields through several different countries, ultimately. There's also the Giant Meter Wave Radio Telescope in India, and this is a drawing of what the Square Kilometer Array may eventually look like, although the design has not yet been nailed down, so it's pretty far in the future, but the idea behind that is just a square kilometer array of radio antennas to look at this kind of signal. Now, I mentioned that you can possibly do a little bit better than the CMB with this stuff. The reason is that you have more information. The 21 centimeter signal is sensitive to both the temperature and ionization of the gas, and because the line is always at 21 centimeters in the rest frame, if you tune your radio telescope to different frequencies, you're just probing different redshifts. And so theoretically, if you tune the radio telescope to a certain frequency, you're going to take a picture at that redshift and then change it and get farther back. So in principle, it's quite a nice thing to be able to do. Just from literature, digging up some ideas of the potential for constraining energy injection rates in the intergalactic medium, you can get something like two orders of magnitude better with 21 centimeter than with the CMB. Yes, question?
Expect to be able to receive, since presumably from decoupling on the signal is produced.
Yeah, so the main problems are going to be things like foregrounds and the atmosphere. So at redshift of something like 70, the atmosphere is opaque and you can't do it from the ground. People have talked about putting a telescope on the other side of the moon to do this because it would reduce a lot of foregrounds and get a nice signal, but no. I think that somewhere around redshift of 50 would be one of the things they're talking about, kind of ideal, or really anything below 50 or so, you might be.
That's already impressive, but somehow in the future you go up with actual 1,000 if you could put something in space.
Yeah, presumably. I'll talk a little bit about foregrounds later. That'll be the biggest problem. There's a lot between here and there, emitting in the radio.
The fact that you can do slices and the fact that it's not just an integrated signal makes this a very good probe. When you look at the CMB and you're trying to work out how the ionization history has changed, you can't really. All you have is this integrated signal. So it's notoriously hard to work out exactly what reionization looks like with just the CMB, because you can change the. If you think it's instantaneous, then you can pin down the redshift of reionization pretty well. But if it's not instantaneous, it's quite hard to find. So the tools that you have here, the main thing is you get the brightness temperature at the telescope, and that depends on the spin temperature of the gas. What you basically get is a contrast between the temperature of the gas and the temperature of the CMB, and you can see the signal and absorption against the CMB. So this is a plot of the top is the CMB temperature, the bottom is the kinetic temperature of the gas, and this dark line is the spin temperature, which relates to the brightness temperature you're going to see in the telescope. And when the spin temperature is below the CMB temperature, you get this signal and absorption in the brightness temperature. And that's what you're basically looking for. It's a little bit more complicated than that, and I'll explain that. Yeah. Yeah. So the things that affect these, at high redshift, the gas is very dense, and so atomic collisions will keep the spin temperature coupled to the kinetic temperature of the gas, and then you get radiative coupling in more intermediate redshifts, and then at some point, stars and galaxies turn on, and that'll drive your spin temperature up, and you can't really do this once you have too much ionization from the stars and galaxies. Back to primordial black holes. Hawking radiation is how the primordial black holes are radiating, and it basically looks like a black body. But if you get more into the details of it, it's a little bit complicated because it depends on the kind of particles and the spectrum isn't perfectly black body. But the things that you need to know for this kind of idea is the temperature will go as the inverse of the mass. So the smaller they are, the hotter. Smaller they are, also the more power they're putting out. And the lifetime scales as m to the third. So there, you can work out exactly when you expect, if they're all produced at the very early universe, you can work out exactly when they're going to be evaporating. And because the power is this function of the mass, most of the energy will be put out right before they completely disappear. So you have the energy injection kind of constant, and then there will be a big spike when they go away. And that would be a cool signal to look for if they were all produced at the same mass. And you might not expect that they would be, but you can kind of correct for that in some way.
Would be roughly produced at the same mass?
Well, yeah, I mean, it depends on how you're forming them. If you talk about using a phase transition to make them all form really quickly, then they'd all be at the mass of the horizon at that time. If you think that they're formed just by collapse of high peaks in the density distribution, they might not all be at the same mass. They might be in a parallel distribution in mass. It depends on how you think they're going to be formed. But it's pretty easy to convert a constraint on single mass into a constraint on spectrum. So I'm just looking at single masses, assuming they're all the same. There's a nice analogy in this kind of thing with decaying dark matter, because decaying dark matter would have roughly the same kind of energy injection, except that it wouldn't spike up at the end.
And there's a recent paper about this that claims that you can. This is the energy injection rate I quoted earlier, using 21 centimeter. And so the basic hypothesis is that primordial black hole evaporation should look pretty much like this, except that unless you're evaporating within the range of the observation. So I'll get back to that. I should explain these plots. This is ionization fraction as a function of redshift, kinetic temperature of the gas as a function of redshift. This is the brightness temperature, and these dotted lines are different models of decaying dark matter. And then this is the power spectrum, and I'll show analogies of these plots for the primordial black holes. So you should never do a calculation before you know the answer. So this is doing a simple order of magnitude estimate of these things. You can work out that you expect ultimately that you might get a constraint on the density parameter of 10 to the minus 12, which is, I think, something like two orders of magnitude better than the current constraints on gamma rays. And the way you do that is you take a constant co-moving number density, uniformly distributed black holes, constant energy injection rate, and just find energy injection per unit volume and compare that to the limits I mentioned above from 21 centimeter. So this looks like a promising technique. In reality, there's a lot more to it than that. First, you have to work out what the Hawking radiation looks like, get all the gray body factors correct, and track the photon energies as a function of redshift. Then you work out what the absorption by the IGM looks like, which is a bit complicated because there's a transparency window where the light might just completely free stream and wouldn't be absorbed at all. So you have to make sure that you're not losing all your photons that way. Work out the total energy injection over the course of the evolution, track the temperature, ionization, brightness temperature, and then ultimately find the power spectrum, because there's going to be a better signal in that than just in the overall sky average signal. So I mentioned the transparency window. This is a plot of optical depth per Hubble time at redshift of 30, and all the different mechanisms for scattering or absorbing photons. And this is one optical depth per Hubble time, is this dotted line here. And so this is the transparency window where you might expect that all the photons that lie in that window are going to free stream. And it turns out that for the kind of masses of primordial black holes people talk about, a lot of the energy does go into this window, so you have to be careful about that. It also turns out that the electron-positron pair production is going to be much more important than the photon production for these kinds of things anyway. So this is kind of a small effect, but it's good to keep in mind. And you can see the transparency window changes as a function of redshift. So that's something you have to also keep in mind. So results. This is a plot of the ionization history comparing dark matter decay and primordial black holes for a mass and number density. I've chosen to make it look as much as possible like dark matter decay, and it really does. It's quite a nice agreement there. This is just the ionization history, so recombination, and then the kind of signal you tend to get is that the ionization comes down and then rises up again at later times. And so this red line is the standard recombination history. And you can do that for several different masses and number densities and get them all to look a lot like decaying dark matter. But then if you have them evaporating early within this time range, then you can get these little spikes, which is where they're suddenly losing all their energy really quickly. And that's kind of cool to see in the ionization history. This is the for mass and the redshift of evaporation. And just as a check, these things, the position of the spikes agree very well with the evaporation redshift you'd expect. But the real signal is in brightness temperature, so you can work out what the brightness temperature looks like as a function of redshift for these things. This green line is for no extra energy injection, just the standard history. And then you get these huge spikes, which would be kind of cool. I mean, even though the brightness temperature signal is a bit hard to find through the foregrounds, I mean, that might be obvious. Also up here, the signal is changing from absorption to emission, which also would be kind of a smoking gun for exotic physics at high redshift. Yeah.
Suppose you were to form them one per Hubble or whatever, at some high redshift, what would be the redshift of that kind of transmission? Would these standards of 10 come to be 11?
I can't remember. It's all a very high redshift, but
Well
before reformation.
Is it before reformation?
So when are you measuring the 11 megabits?
Sir?
When are you measuring the 11 megabits?
So that's the, it would be today if they survived.
So if it's 10 to the minus 12 today, then you can go back, the universe can grow 10 to the 12 times larger, it can still be, at that point, it'd be equivalent to radiation. We know you've gotten back up to 11. If it's 10 to the minus 12 about radiation equality, then universe can go 10, I mean, the black hole omega will, the two omegas will differ by a factor that's proportional to how much the universe is growing.
Yeah, and the omega. So what you usually put for these things is the omega when they're formed, and there's a relationship between that and the current one. I'm just quoting for some people are more interested in that now.
But that's ignoring the decay.
So it's the omega of stuff in the universe. Sorry?
It's the omega that would be now if it didn't decay.
Yeah. Or it's the omega of the stuff they're responsible for.
Supposing they were lighter and did the decay of around decoupling or earlier, is that ruled out by some signal?
So you're saying that if they decay, the spike comes like right here,
or even before,
or right here. So the thing is that they wouldn't be able to increase the ionization fraction because everything is already ionized. So we wouldn't see that.
So
you can't see them in 21 centimeters because they're neutral gas.
So are there any limits to a population of primordial black holes?
Yeah, there are limits based on them messing with nucleosynthesis by putting too much energy out at that time. There are other limits that I can't mention obviously at the top of my head, but yeah, there are constraints out there, but for the study, we can't get those. You'd have spectral distortions, like the Y tracker mutation. That's something that we talked about in the other primordial black hole paper of mine, but I'm not going to talk about as much here. But you can come and ask me about it later if you're really interested. Or free.
So I mentioned that foregrounds are a problem. The expected signal from these things is quite small. This is 10 millikelvin, and you can make an estimate of the foregrounds from free emission of just blobs of ionized gas in the galaxy. And depending on whether these things are Poisson statistics or clustered, you have different levels of emission. Actually, this might be also extragalactic emission. In any case, you have a problem with the foregrounds here, and the main foreground is actually synchrotron emission, but that we're a little more optimistic about that one because it has a very smooth spectrum and frequency space, and so theoretically you should be able to just take that right out because the 21 centimeter signal should not be smooth in frequency space, but something like this would be more of a problem because it or if you're trying to look for the spatial signal, it's more of a problem because you don't know already where all these things are going to be and the scales and all that. So it's difficult. It's going to be a very hard signal to find. One of the biggest foregrounds actually is terrestrial because it turns out that this 21 centimeter signal, when redshifted to the redshifts we're interested in, tends to coincide with radio and TV and mobile phones. This telescope that's in the Netherlands is in a very flat place with lots of people around, and that they're going to have quite a lot of trouble getting their terrestrial foregrounds to go away. There's also there are telescopes being built in the Australian outback, which might be a little better with those. A lot better. There's one being built on a mountain in China that has a ground shield composed of other mountains, which also would be good. But this is one of the reasons people talk about going to the moon. I think it's a cool idea, putting a radio telescope on the far side of the moon, but it's probably a bit ambitious. So, no, I mean it's still a problem. And also, I mean, one of the telescopes they're using right now, the giant meter radio telescope in India, I think one of the problems they have is that when an airplane comes overhead, it reflects signals from other parts of the country, and that's really hard to take out because it's an airplane and you can't really predict where and when it is or what shape it is, and you know it's difficult. This is kind of distant future kind of stuff. But one of the things that you might try is looking at the 21 centimeter power spectrum and get a statistical detection. Just to put these equations up here, the power spectrum depends on the square of the brightness temperature. So I showed the plot of that before, and that'll be important. And also, this is the baryon power spectrum. And this is the kind of error you might expect to get on the power spectrum. For a very ambitious future telescope, but it depends on the size of the telescope, the scale you're looking at, the redshift of the sources, and so on. And that's the estimate that I'm going to do is to say if you can tell the difference between the no injection case and the primordial black hole case to a level within this error, then that's something that's detectable. So here's just an example of the dotted line is the power spectrum for no primordial black holes, and this solid line is for an omega of 6 to the minus 7 in 10 to the 12 kilogram black holes. And I'm choosing quite a large omega in primordial black holes just for illustrative purposes. But you can see that there are regions where the power spectrum will be quite different, and it depends on the mass of the primordial black holes and such. And so you can plot the this plot didn't come out very well, but the limit of observability is a function of redshift for the same telescope and the same wave number. And then if the difference in the two signals rises above that, you should be able to distinguish them. So the constraint, this is kind of preliminary, but this is the gamma ray constraint, this dashed line here. And here's what we got for the 21 centimeter constraint. The dotted line is where they're evaporating too early to really be constrainable in this way, but we get down to about 10 to the minus 12 in omega, whereas the gamma ray constraint is only about 10 to the minus 10. So it will potentially be the best constraint on these primordial black holes in mass ranges around here. So it's about my time's about up. So conclusions. The basic idea here is that we should all be using 21 centimeter observations to detect any kind of physics that's putting energy out in the dark ages, because there's nothing else there, and it's a very cool kind of observation if we can do it, and it would be very obvious if there was something strange going on, because unless you have something like annihilating dark matter, decaying dark matter, primordial black holes, you should have a very clean and uninteresting signal there, and you can use this to specifically improve on limits on primordial black holes, but you can also look at other exotic physics, and there have been papers about, as I said, decaying dark matter, annihilating dark matter, other kinds of particle decay. So it's a cool thing, and there's so much being invested in it now in observational astronomy that it's going to be kind of the next big tool that in some ways can do better than CMB. So that's my conclusion, and here's a movie of ionization happening. That's it.
Yep. Massive particles. How long can their lifetime be, and or how slow can they decay, and you still see a signal in the 21 centimeter line? Because okay. Presumably if they decay slowly, then there will be no spike, right?
Right. So I'm going to refer you to this very nice paper by Perletta Owens and Pierre Pauli. I'm not going to use this later, but it's okay. So I have it written down. So the lifetime, you can constrain lifetimes of about 10 to the 27 seconds.
This is kind of strange that you can produce. I hadn't thought of this, that you can produce stuff from these black holes that's well above the temperature of the UV cell by time.
Yeah, because they're small enough to be quite hot.
Yeah.
They don't care about their
matter. So can you make dark matter in these?
I
mean, presumably black dark matter particles also get emitted as walking radiation. Can you make?
Well, everything that bubbles in gravity gets emitted.
Yeah. So you can emit dark matter from these things, and then I mean, I guess I'm wondering. So you want some? You want really small ones where they don't have enough energy? I guess that they.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know, maybe this happens too early on or something.
But you're going to down it from, you know, 10 to the minus 10, 10 to the minus 12. So what they mean is not going to make the size of the water in the dark
matter. Oh, so maybe you run into
the problem. These aren't real constraints. These are predicted constraints. They haven't been.
Well, the 10 to the minus
10
is a real constraint.
But for some amount of
memory.
For some
mass,
right?
Okay, so you get too many photons for a given, for a thing that may.
Yeah. I mean, there are ranges where the constraints are not as good, so that's just the best constraint currently, although the lowest constraint currently. But there are other ranges, both lower and higher masses, that are not as well constrained.
Okay, can you make massive particles from hawking radiation?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. It just reduces the number that are emitted.
Which is the very end, I would suppose.
I thought that massive particles couldn't get out the horizon at all.
If the energy, if the temperature is higher than the mass of the particles,
yeah, so that's the very last, like a second.
Right.
Or very small platform.
Yeah, but I mean, what you're showing is like a whole period of emission. So I guess the last maybe, I don't know, microsecond or something, you can maybe.
If they start out small enough, you can emit all sorts of things. It just depends on the mass of whatever. Let's begin again. So that's it for today's talks. We have all night.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.